She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. Our show today is made possible due to the generous support of the Chapman Automotive Group. We thank them for their support and for definitely doing their share and showing they care. My hat's off to their Community Green team for all their hard work throughout the year in the community and within the seven dealerships. Thanks for all you're doing to make our world a cleaner, healthier place. The name of our show today is actually the name of the book we will be discussing, The Last Unicorn, A Search for One of Earth's Rarest Creatures. Our guest is the author of that book. His name is William DeBuys. Bill is the author of 8 books, including River of Traps, A New Mexico Mountain Life. It's a New York Times Notable Book of the Year and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in General Nonfiction in 1991, and also A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. And you can download my interview that I did with Bill in 2002 about that book. And Bill, we're really thrilled to have you as a return guest. You can tell by how I'm rushing through the intro that it's like, okay, get to the show.
Well, it's great to be with you again, Gina. I really appreciate the opportunity.
You know, I have been doing this, I think, for 8 years, and I should count the number of interviews. And I really say this with a very open and sincere heart. Your book is really about an incredible journey, one that few in the world will ever take or have taken, and it all started with a phone call in 2009. It's about the Saula, which is an animal that you describe like a unicorn, but prior to that conversation with Jack Tardoff, had you ever even heard of one, and what was the question?
I think I may have read about Saula back in the 90s when the animal was first discovered to Western science. But when Jack Tardoff called me, and I suppose it was 2009, and asked, would you like to write about Saula? I had never at that time heard the word spoken. I think I'd only seen it printed. And so when he said it, I didn't know what he was talking about because I had no association for the sound of the word.
And he wanted you to write about it. And then just like I said to you when I talked to you off air, we should have made this a two-part series, and I want you to take your time answering questions, but you have to set some scenes for us because that's the magic of the book that makes you not want to put it down. So fast forward to February 24th, 2011, and you are beginning your journey in Laos with Bill Robichaud. Is that how you say his name?
Robichaud.
Yeah. Okay, a very experienced field biologist with extensive experience in Southeast Asia. I was reading things and saying, are you kidding me right now? This is where he's lived. This is what he's done. This is his life. So where are you? Who are you with? And did you have any idea of what actually would lie ahead? I mean, that's a pretty sequential 3-part question.
Yeah. Well, just to start with the last question, I think if I had really known what I was getting into, I might not have gone.
I would not have gone.
But I had great faith in this fellow Robichaud. He's the coordinator. He's really the chairman, but he doesn't like the hierarchical sound of that word. So he just goes by coordinator of the Saula Working Group, which is a committee of conservation biologists and land administrators in Southeast Asia. And the biologists come from the UK and the United States, Vietnam, Laos, all around. Bill is the coordinator of this group, and the group's mission is to save the Saula from extinction. And after this fellow, Jack Tardoff, had called me and said, do you want to write about Saula? And I said, what?
What and where?
Yeah. Well, after a while, what Tordoff told me is that the cell is an amazing animal. It's beautiful. It's physically large. It's one of the it's the largest land mammal discovered in the last 50 years. And it has beautiful, long, straight, pointed horns, or nearly straight horns, beautiful markings on its muzzle. It has an absolutely serene disposition, which Robichaud discovered when he observed a captive Salah for 2 weeks in 1996. In any event, after this conversation with Tordoff, Tordoff wound up sending me to a meeting of the Salah Working Group, which is a committee of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And at that meeting, I met Bill Robichaud. This was in Vientiane, Laos, the capital of Laos. And this is 2009. And Robichaud and I began a conversation then that continued back stateside when Robichaud was making his periodic trips back to the States. And he stayed at my house. I later stayed at his house in Vientiane. We became friends, and I just had enormous confidence in him. And when he invited me to go on an expedition with him into the true wilds of Laos, close by the Vietnam border in central Laos, when he invited me to go with him, I thought, well, sure, let's go. And what ensued was, I think, in many respects, the greatest single adventure of my life.
No doubt. It's like I was talking out loud when I was reading the book. Mostly it was, are you kidding me right now? And rereading passages from a very deep place of respect and awe. I mean, the whole captivating concept of Laos, it's very unexplored by Westerners. Most people think of it as a place where we bombed, and Westerners
yes.
are not seen in the deepest, darkest, and most, you know, dense is a better word, of the villages and the places that you went as recently as the 21st century. I mean, it's not like you went there 40 years ago. This is a turn back in time. So what was the, I guess I want to ask you, what were some of your biggest fears, and what was it like as you started the journey? Give us a picture as best you can of the places you were going to see.
Well, I'll tell you, when we were in the town of Nakai, on the edge of the wilderness we were about to go into, the night before we set out, I actually sort of interviewed myself in my journal and asked, what are your biggest fears about this expedition you're about to go on? And my answer was, first, that I had the fear that I might not be able to hold up physically to the challenges that lay ahead. And the second fear I had was that we might only see destruction and images of sadness. We knew we were going into an area that suffers from very heavy poaching from professional gangs of poachers who cross the mountains from Vietnam and capture wildlife for the wildlife trade in Vietnam, supplying markets in China, both for so-called medicines and also for the status bushmeat restaurant trade. So those were my two big fears going in, and both were legitimate. I mean, it was an enormous physical challenge to get through this. You know, I was 61 years old when I did this, and most of the people on the expedition were in their mid-20s, most of them being Lao, or actually Sek villagers, a tribal unit, an ethnic unit of the Lao nation.
And teenagers, and there you were, the grandfather of the group.
I was the old man.
I was like, whoa.
The old guy with the white beard.
No kidding, which they also hadn't seen.
No. Sure. And the second fear about seeing destruction, well, we did see a lot of destruction. We saw a lot of terrible things results of this, of the poaching business going on in there. But as you pointed out early on in our conversation, the book is about a journey. It's about a quest. And we were after the Saula. That was the object of our quest. But, you know, maybe the oldest literary form in human culture is the story of the quest. And many of those stories, if you read back, the quest turn out to find something, but not always the thing that it set out to find.
Right, right.
And that was the case for us. What we wound up finding, we had in the wilds, in the deep forests, the jungles of Laos, close by the Vietnam border there, we had deep encounters with beauty. And that's the thing that I took back from our journey more than anything else, was this sense of the enormous, infinite beauty of that place and really of our planet. Bill Robichaux and I got to places on that expedition where ours were the first blue eyes that had ever seen them.
I love that part, describing it. I mean, Westerners had never set eyes, and you were describing it in such a way, which is why I think your book got such incredible reviews with people of such magnitude in my world. You know, like Paul Hawken and my very, very favorite Jane Goodall. I'm going to give a quote about her, but I want to read one quote because I think it's so reflective of the captivating prose that I, and I'm sure many others, thoroughly enjoyed about your writing, and that I almost relished reading them throughout the book, where you took a departure from the facts of what you were describing as the scribe. But it says, "So distant is the Saula from the tumbling ruminants with which it shares the greater part of the genes that it seems closer, at least in a metaphorical way, to a creature of myth. In its spirit, or perhaps only in the spirit that Westerners pursuing it, imagining it to have, the Saula seems kindred to the fabled unicorn of medieval times. Like the unicorn, it is as rare as the rarest thing on earth." Well, that made me want to read more. And is that kind of what was in your soul as you started the journey?
Yes, absolutely. And the Saula for us, as the unicorn was for many people in the medieval era, it was a kind of concentration, an embodiment of enigma, of elusiveness, of beauty, of the specialness that can exist in nature. And what more engaging, what more exciting thing to pursue than that? We were in a sense bewitched by the idea of this thing, and delightedly so.
And for a nonfiction book, the prose and the descriptions, I will say that throughout the show, but there was something else that was going on in the region at that time, and I wanted your comments on that. It was a very changing landscape. The development of the large-scale, internationally funded hydropower project. And what I quote from the book, in one of the largest construction projects underway on the planet, these people, they would demonstrate how economic development and environmental protection might be made not just compatible, but synergistic. At least that was the hope. What is your view on the success of that statement as they went forward?
Well, on paper, it all looked good. In practice, it's not coming through. It could perhaps still be rescued, the situation there. The idea was that revenue from electricity production,
right,
from the hydro dam, that a dedicated stream of revenue would be used to guarantee the genuine protection of the biodiversity of a large and very important area. In actual application, as they say, there's many a trip twixt cup and lip, and things have spilled. And humans don't tend to execute big programs as perfectly as the architects of those programs predict. And that's what we're seeing there. If very, very significant changes are made, if there's really strong leadership, the situation can still be rescued. But it's not moving strongly in the direction it needs to move right now.
And it's a very honest conundrum or contradiction in terms that you very sensitively describe in the book, because modernization brings things that are good, economic development and education, medical, you know, the access to medical care. That's one of the upsides, but the incredible, and how can we not expect people to want that? But at what cost? I mean, to me, it seemed from the book that there was a tremendous cost to the development of that hydropower project.
An enormous cost.
Devastating cost.
Yes, absolutely. And it is, in a way, bringing economic, not in a way, it is bringing economic advancement, defined in the usual way, to that area. But it's also bringing access to markets in a way that allows people to make money, advance themselves economically by exploiting the wildlife of the area and using the wildlife to approach ever more the sort of ideal of consumer lifestyle that they can pick up via satellite TV connections, seeing how people in Bangkok live, for instance.
And, having TV and wanting to live that way and have those things that are, you know, sought after. And it's to be in Laos and some of the villages you were in, even today, and to know what modern world looks like, it's almost unimaginable. That's how I felt when I was reading the book. It's like, this was unimaginable. And it was only 3 weeks. So to write a book about these challenges, that's what was blowing me. I kept saying, really? Is it still only February 28th?
Right.
I'm reading this. So what
about... one of those things where 1 minute we might be offered a nice refreshing snack of pig's blood.
We have to talk about that.
And the next, there would be... a commercial or a soap opera from Thai TV, you know, showing amidst a lot of electronic snow on the wall. It was a jarring place of cognitive dissonance. Let's put it that way.
Totally. And even for Robichaux, when you are in, I think it's Bantong, and excuse me for any pronunciations, but he observed a changing landscape from when he had just been there 2 years ago.
He said it was
unrecognizable, the modern ways, but lots of devastation to the environment.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, motorbikes were showing up, little sawmills, more metal roofs on the previously thatched-roofed houses. All kinds of things were showing up that were driven basically by the appearance in the local economy of large amounts of new cash. And a lot of that new cash was coming from wildlife trade, from, you know, selling turtles for turtle blood, for deer horn, anything you might imagine that might find its way into the hands of Vietnamese traders who would carry it back across the mountains and sell it for a handsome profit in Hanoi and on up to Guangzhou in China.
And a market that's actually rapidly expanding. So we're going to have to take our first break in about a minute. And everybody, I'm sure you're going to want to stay here with me, be on this journey with me. Our guest today is Bill DeBuys. He's the author of a book, The Last Unicorn, A Search for One of Earth's Rarest Creatures. The book is about this award-winning stirring quest to find and understand a very elusive and exceptionally rare species in the heart of Southeast Asia's jungles, the Saola. When you come back, Bill, I'd love to talk a little bit more about how the breadth of Chinese medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, and we'll talk about the snares and what some of the village experiences were like. Everybody, please stay here with me.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at mrsgreensworld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at mrsgreensworld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the Igloo radio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmer Glass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@mrsgreensworld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
In the mid-Tucson summer, you would expect it to be over 100 degrees. But deep beneath the University of Arizona's compost heap, temperatures can hit 160. Started by the Compost Cats student group, the U of A Compost Project is collecting tons of waste from around campus and keeping it out of landfills. Gathering garbage and converting it into a useful product for the community? Now that's a hot idea indeed. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back. Back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I will get in trouble from my show producer if I don't mention the summer giveaway that we have starting June 22nd. It's a scavenger hunt on the Mrs. Green's World website. And the first four participants to submit all three correct answers will win one of four prize packages, including a swell bottle, a glass Dharma straw set, and a copy of Mrs. Green's book, Your Mother Called, Mother Earth. You better call her back. Check it out on our website. And the reason we're doing it is so that people can become more familiar with the incredible content that we have on our website, which is reflective of the quality of guests we have on the show. Our guest today is the author of The Last Unicorn, A Search for One of Earth's Rarest Creatures. The book is about Bill Dubois, got it, Bill, award-winning quest to find and understand an elusive and exceptionally rare species in the heart of Southeast Asia's jungles, the Saula. It's a mystical description. It's a elusive thought, and it is the elusive butterfly, which we'll go on throughout the show telling about. And Bill, if it's okay, can I read the quote from Jane Goodall? She's, of course, iconic in the world of environmentalism, preservation of species, and she kind of captured for me, of all the reviews I read, why someone would want to read this book.
Oh, of course. I'm so grateful for what Dr. Jane said about
the last, one of the most gracious human beings. I was as nervous as I've ever been for any interview I've done when I had her on the show. And of course, she put me at ease. She's so an unbelievable human being. So here's what she says. The Last Unicorn is a book you simply must read. For one thing, Bill Dubois has a real gift for storytelling. So true, says Mrs. Green. And this story, the quest for an animal that was driven to the point of extinction almost as soon as it was discovered, is a true adventure. Bill's powerful prose leads us deep into the wilderness in an almost unknown part of the world, and it sends out a clarion call bidding us to redouble our efforts to save the last wild places and vanishing animals before it is utterly too late. What a great quote, and Bill, is that so reflective of your quest?
Well, I think Dr. Jane captured the book quite well.
She nailed it.
As she does most things.
Quite things, exactly. So in the book, there's a couple of things that I think you have to try and at least give us a description of what a typical day was when you were trekking from one camp to another. What kind of things did you face, and like the food you ate, how dense the jungle was? You may or may not, up to you, bring up leeches, which to me was the absolute most horrific, creepiest part of the book. That was like terrifying for me to read about that. So talk about what a typical day was, if there was such a thing.
Well, I suppose there was. We were on the trail for several weeks, as you mentioned, and you know, we would start. The guides would cook some sticky rice in the morning, and usually while they were cooking, Robichaux and I would go out and try to census the birds of the area. When we came back, the food would be ready. We would eat, and the food, I must say, did not feel to me to be very nourishing or very palatable.
Just disgusting.
But off we would go onto the trail, and we would cover a lot of ground most days, probably 6 or 8 kilometers before we stopped for lunch. And sometimes we were on the kinds of trails that you might see in a national forest or a national park in the United States, that is to say trails that were clearly recognizable and easy to follow. Usually they were in that condition because they were heavily used by poachers. Some days, however, we would strike off and go, as it were, cross-country and follow a compass heading through the jungle. And this was not flat country. These were mountains, and so we were climbing very precipitous hills, very steep hills, sometimes so steep you had to use your hands, often going down canyon sides. You had to reach out and grab trees or whatever structure there was to try to slow yourself so you didn't go too fast. It was very rough going and hard footing, usually pretty hot, usually always quite humid, and so water was always a concern. It's kind of interesting to be in that part of the world which has so much water, and your biggest fear is nevertheless dehydration.
Right, and making sure you didn't drink anything that was not, you didn't bring little critters into your body along with the drinking of the water.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh.
Coming from the arid Southwest, I found that, you know, my cooling system in my body was very ill-adapted to that country. I do very well out here in the arid lands, but in the humid lands, boy, I couldn't get enough water in me.
I'm prone to hyperbole throughout the conversation, but there are two threads that you weave throughout the book, the reasons for the devastation, the road to extinction. Can you share with us the challenges that are brought about by people's beliefs in traditional Chinese medicine, that they actually have some healing properties that I find hard to find any research to support, but it's a very strongly held, pervasive belief about their healing powers. Talk to us a little bit about that, and is there any science behind it at all? Like, does turtle blood really make me cancer-free for the rest of my life? I mean, it's very devastating and yet so pervasive.
Yeah, it's a sad story, and one of the continuing tragedies on this planet today, that so many people believe that if you ingest the parts of an animal, you will be able to build into your own tissues some of the spirit of that animal. That's the underlying concept behind at least the animal parts segment of traditional Chinese medicine and traditional Asian medicines in general. And so in application, that means, well, if a turtle is known for its long life, and turtles do live long time, then turtle blood, if you ingest turtle blood, then that will help you live longer. If tigers are fierce and strong and very virile, let's say, then if you ingest powdered tiger bone, you will be fierce and strong and very virile. All these kinds of things. I mean, the idea that a monkey, you know, which is so agile, if you ingest some form, some derivative of monkey hands, then that will help your hands stay flexible and stave off arthritis. I mean, there's no medical basis for any of these kinds of ideas, but these ideas persist. And in East Asia now, as economies expand, there are many more well-to-do people, many more billionaires, millionaires, year after year, who can afford to pay for very expensive treatments and therapies based on animal fluids and tissues and fats and so forth. And the result is that there's a booming market for animal parts that is being fed by pervasive poaching all over Asia and throughout much of Africa, and even slipping over into other continents as well.
And you know, weaving through the story of this magnificent journey, there's those beliefs and traditions. But is it fair to say that critical to your success along the journey was paying homage to the chief, what was expected of you in terms of their offerings of food and drink? I mean, honestly, it was killing me to read some of it. The pig blood is one example that stands out. But was it not critical to your success and getting the tribal chief's blessing to continue the journey?
Absolutely. Our journey really had three purposes, three missions. One was to evaluate an unvisited area, an unexplored area of the forest, to evaluate it for as Sala habitat. Another was to assess the level of poaching pressure being exerted in that area. And a third was to conduct what you might call conservation diplomacy. And so in all the villages we went to, we met with the village headman. We talked about ways to promote conservation practices. We tried to explore ways to create reward systems for conservation activity, for different styles of hunting, for less use of dogs in hunting, which are a big problem for the survival of Sala, things of that sort. And we also just had to be on good terms with the headman, just in order to be able to recruit the porters and guides that we needed and to be able to come and go in the villages and get our work done. So it's very important to be on good terms, and Robichaud was absolutely a marvel in all these undertakings. He speaks Lao quite fluently. He says not, but sounds fluent to me.
Sounds to me like he really does well.
Yes, and he's so graceful socially with all those people. I mean, it's not just an act. The man really loves that part of the world, loves the people who inhabit it, speaks so highly of them, and they respond to his good nature and good humor in kind.
And just
he's
to be
a
able
very
to,
funny man, and we had a lot of sort of raucous, crazy good times as we went along.
Which is, to me, the most challenging nuance with a second language is humor. Translating humor is very difficult, and obviously throughout the book he was successful at it. You know, I want to ask you about the toast with Lady Torquemada, I think that's how you say your name. It was an epic scene for me. First of all, it was a woman. And second of all, it felt like she was really challenging you when it came to the drinking of the pig blood, which was, I mean, I can't say it any other way. It was so disgusting to me. Like, I had to read it and reread it, which is sick. But what was the feeling going on with you when that happened? What was the scene, and what did she do?
Well, it was clear that she was trying to get us into a kind of etiquette headlock, where she, as the gracious hostess, would be offering us things that we could not refuse. And she kind of upped the ante moment by moment, you know, through beer and through whiskey, and then finally to the pig's blood, and tried to get us to drink it. And, gosh, we probably would have, or I might have tasted it at least, but just that afternoon, we'd been told that all the pigs in the village were dying from some unknown cause, and I thought, well, maybe that's a reason not to partake of a just dead pig that might have had some kind of horrible organic distemper that could communicate to me.
Right.
So anyway, it was quite a funny experience, and I must say a fairly drunken one. as Lady Torquemada, that's the name I gave her, as she tried, she was just playing games with the foreigners. And later I talked with the renowned conservation biologist, George Schaller, who's worked all over the world, and he said, oh yeah, in Laos, that's the first thing they try to do is to get you to drink pig blood.
It's like, that is so gross. And, you know, I have to share this with you because I was trying to figure out what I was feeling throughout different chapters of the book. And I went from, if only a helicopter could drop ship me in a package, to what some of the things you were seeing in terms of the beauty and the pristine nature and the birds and the incredibly rich descriptions you gave, to other scenes where I thought to myself, truly, I'm going to live a really good life, because if I die and go to hell, I'm going to end up in this scene. I was feeling it. I'm like, so, seriously, I'm like, if I die and go to hell, someone's going to expect me to even look at pig blood, let alone drink it. And what about, like, were you expecting, like, the, I don't know what it is, the sparsity, the starkness, the, I don't know, of where places you had to sleep and what you had to sleep on and mean dogs. I mean, was that part of things that didn't surprise you because maybe Robichaud explained it? Or what were some of those challenges? It was challenging for me to read.
Yeah, I wasn't too surprised by the curs in the village, the dogs that beset us sometimes. And I was prepared to carry a stake to ward them off, and that wasn't a big deal. And I've done a lot of things outdoors, and so camping in a precarious spot and pitching my tent where there really wasn't room for it, that kind of thing, wasn't too unusual.
You weren't expecting the Ritz-Carlton, but this was like really...
No, well, long way from the Ritz-Carlton. And as you say, there were some hellish moments, but there were a lot of heavenly ones, too. I mean, when I think back to that adventure, one of the first things that comes to mind is waking in one of the great grasslands back in the heart of the forest, of the jungle, and waking to the sound of gibbons hooting in the morning. It's one of the most magical sounds in all of nature. And I just hope I live long enough to experience that sound firsthand again.
That's a wonderful, really, what a testimonial to have. And I want to make sure that I focus enough on the beauty, because that's what kept me wanting to read, and your description of the scenes. And also the relationship with the guides. I mean, there were some certainly special moments and times which they were very protective of you in silent and respectful ways. I mean, there were beautiful scenes that you describe that are important to highlight as well, not just the pig blood. I got a little fixated on that, I admit it.
It's like, oh, it's easy to do.
It's really tough for this little American girl from New Jersey. Unbelievable. What about just on the very up note, I think it would be wonderful if you could... When we come back, it's going to be 2 minutes. I'm getting a two-minute warning, and the time's going so fast. But back to the Saula and the emotional description of describing it as the underdog. And one of the quotes was, you know, it's actually best to leave it alone, and yet humans can't. I mean, this was the discovery that sent a ripple throughout the world, your world, about, and in many circles, discovery of a species. I mean, that's the magic of why people should read this book, and many other reasons. But what kind of, it's again, that cognitive dissonance. You want to study it, you want to know about it, but the best thing and what it wants is to be left alone. Is that true?
Exactly, yeah. You know, the discovery of the Saula itself is a great story, quite an adventure story on its own, and that's told in the book. What happened after the Saula was discovered is that suddenly so many people wanted samples of it, wanted to know about it, and the word went out to villagers in Saula habitat, and they began trapping specifically for Saula and capturing them. And so many Saula died in that effort that in a way the discovery turned out to be a curse for the animal itself. which, as Robichaux poetically pointed out, does no one any harm. It doesn't eat people's crops. It doesn't hurt people. It just wants to be left alone in its jungle, in its habitat. It just wants to be left to contribute its little bit of beauty to the world.
Let's hold that thought when we come back. Lots more good and beautiful things and a little bit about the ugly side of the adventure to Laos. Stay here with me, everybody.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Do you dare to share? In 2009, the University of Arizona started its car sharing program. Today, students, faculty, and staff have access to a shared fleet of cars that includes 7 hybrids and even the zero emissions Nissan Leaf. Not only does car sharing give the campus community wheels, but it takes all those extra cars off the road too. Now that greens things up, doesn't it? The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everyone, and thank you for joining us. The name of our show today is The Last Unicorn, a search for one of Earth's rarest creatures. We are so privileged to have as our guest the author of the book that bears that same title. His name is Bill DeBuise. The book is about this author's award. He's an award-winning author, but this book, you guys, I just want to do the shout-out. Trust me, read the book. It's about the stirring quest to find and understand an elusive and exceptionally rare species in the heart of Southeast Asia's jungles, the Saola. The book reviews are fabulous. I mean, Bill, it had to be happy days when you started getting some of these book reviews from icons in the environmental world globally. It was just pretty impressive, and I'm so glad that you reached out to have to be on the show again. I'm like, oh my goodness. So there's.
Oh, I wouldn't have missed it. I enjoyed so much our conversation in 2012. For a great aridness. And
what blows me away is that you could write that book and then write this book. And now I have on my list to read some of your other books that sound equally as fascinating. And I have to keep using the word, your descriptive prose is certainly one of your major, major gifts. Let's talk a little bit about the level of trust and the relationship you had to have with people whose culture is very different from ours. From my experience, very secretive at times. Can you talk a little bit about the relationships? I mean, they were so interdependent. You all needed each other.
Yes, we did. And I'll tell you, among the guides who helped us were some teenagers, some just kids. They were, you know, they were half my size. They carried twice my load. They were a third my age. Or less, a quarter my age, and I couldn't converse with them. I didn't speak Lao, or I spoke only a few words of Lao. We couldn't really talk, but doggone it, they're pretty much like kids anywhere, and they were so open-hearted and so enthusiastic and really so cool to be around, and they did, in fact, look out for the old foreigner, the old Falang.
With the gray hair and the blue eyes.
With the gray hair and the blue eyes and the strangely shaped European format skull and all the rest. And, you know, in a way, this journey into the greatest foreignness you can imagine was also a journey into the great commonality of people everywhere. And it was a delight to be with these people, all but one. Who
one
became
jerk.
A kind of vexation for
one
us.
One jerk,
and,
yes.
And his name was Yang Zai, and even as he was driving me crazy, I was very grateful for him because I knew that having at least one mischief maker, if not a full-blown villain, would make the narrative of this trip much better.
It made it quite engaging. And, you know, there was another part of it that I wondered what happened for you, because there is a type of person that studies endangered species. And, you know, your relatability to that, which made it relatable for me. And I took a quote from the book, "The outlook is almost universally grim if you're studying endangered species. And yet funds are raised, the difficult field conditions endured," excuse me, underscored difficult field conditions, "the bureaucracies contended with, and 1,000 complications overcome to allow the work to continue." This was your journey. This was your journey. And
yes, it was. And every journey, I mean, for me, every book is a journey. And every book produces, for me, serious learning. I mean, it's serious advancement in my own thinking. At least I hope it's advancement. And in this case, with The Last Unicorn, I felt as though I really came close to something, which is at the core of trying to do this work to save wildlife, to save endangered species. And I saw it in Robichaux, as I also saw it in a friend of mine who, through this same period, was dying of cancer. And that is the ability to be realistic, to be even fatalistic, to truly appraise the difficulty of the situation one is in, but at the same time to maintain a kind of joie de vivre and a hope.
Right.
To be optimistic and fatalistic at the same time, to combine those two contradictory ideas in the mind at the same time and embody them in one's action. And in a way, I think that realization, that epiphany, the story about that is the emotional and moral heart of the book that I tried to write.
You did write it. And the gratitude I felt about your openness, because you just walk into this abyss with no communication to the outside world, knowing that your friend Mary could die of cancer, very, very dear friend. And I believe right when you set off, your Joanne's mother died.
So my partner Joanna's mother died just as I was landing or shortly after I arrived in Laos.
And you couldn't keep calling and checking in, but the trust and, I mean, the strength of those relationships was so apparent in the book. It was again what makes the book, in my opinion, unique. It's the story of the search or the Saula, but it's much more interwoven with Bill DeBuise's personal journeys, which make it captivating. It's what was happening. What about the trade of wildlife and precious wood? I, for one, even as Mrs. Green, was not aware of the devastating impact for the trading of rosewood. Is it just that now we're seeing the particular ugliness of this, or is it accelerating? What are your thoughts on that? I mean, it's devastating.
Yes, and it's been going on for quite some time. The fact is, we are ransacking this planet. People read in the newspaper about what's happening in Africa right now in the pursuit of ivory, which is also driven by a Chinese market. And what we have to bear in mind is that what's happening with elephants and ivory is happening with countless other species.
Rhinos, tigers, yes.
Yeah, and lots of small species, amphibians even, and turtles, and Saula, for that matter, and barking deer, and you name it. We are putting terrific pressure on the natural life of the planet, but it's not hopeless, because if people in an area begin to see the wildlife around them as assets, and this does happen, and if they can provide eyes and ears to help patrol their areas, to protect the wildlife, and this happens, and if there is some kind of a responsive force, often it has to be a quasi-military force, that local people can call on to block the predation by outsiders of their wildlife. And if this is the fourth condition, if the government authorities behind that responsive force are not corrupt, then you can protect, then we all can protect beachheads of safe wildlife habitat, be it in Kenya for elephants and tigers, elephants and lions, or in India for tigers, or in Laos for sawla and other keystone species. We just need to protect these key areas and hope that over the next generation or two, there will be enough cultural change to curtail, to diminish the demand for animal parts. And this can happen. We're already seeing it with shark fins. A wonderful NGO based in San Francisco called Wild Aid has done a lot of work in China to educate people about shark fins. And today, the market for shark fins in Guangzhou is down 82% from what it was just a few years ago.
That is such good news. I mean, such really good news.
Yeah, it is. And two-thirds of Chinese consumers who were polled on this said that they had given up eating and serving and buying shark fin soup because of the public education campaigns that have been on Chinese media. So the necessary cultural change can happen, and we just have to protect key areas while that change takes the time it needs to occur.
It's and we have to keep remembering those things, especially when you do the shows that I do. Some days you just want to go back to bed and pull the covers over your head and say, just wait, bring it on. And yet there is so much hope, and that's what we have to keep focused on. So I figure it's safe to say that the worst day on your trip was the day that you got violently ill from eating eggs.
Yes.
What inside you, did you come close to saying, I quit, I'm going back, or did that never occur to you? Because, I mean, you were really, really sick.
Yeah, and I thought, well, I guess one way out of this is to say I quit. And then the moment I imagined that action, the moment I imagined quitting and turning my back on what we were doing, I felt even more revolted, more revulsed by that thought than I had been physically by the illness. And so I just decided, okay, whatever you do, just keep putting one foot in front of the other and make it through, make it happen.
Literally. I mean, literally. Yeah. And I felt it. It was like, oh my gosh, he's going on. You take a big global look about conservation in the book and why it's such a complex issue, especially in places like areas of Laos. Why is it so complex? It's like you want to conserve it, but you want to study it. And if the roads are built, it gives access to observing it, but it's devastating. I mean, all those thoughts were going on in my head. What in your mind is the big global conversation that we all need to be having about it and why it's so important?
Well, I think we just have to, first of all, agree on values about protecting what's out there. We want to be compassionate. We want to see all people advance and enjoy the greatest opportunities possible. But that often comes at a cost to the natural world. And we've got to do what we can to protect the beauty that remains in the natural world. And what we find in conservation is so often that, you know, the biological ecology is relatively simple to understand. It's the cultural and political, the human ecology, that presents the greatest challenge to preserving the marvels of this incredibly marvelous planet that we live on.
Complex issue. And I mean, especially Laos, it is one of the last untamed, unexplored areas. I mean, I'm sure there are places that people with gray hair and blue eyes have never set eyes on. And the like George Schaller, who is incredible in his world, he left Laos and he said, I give up. The government is not serious about conservation. What do you, Bill DeBuise, think today, fast forward? Are they serious? Are they getting more serious?
I think they're getting more serious, and they have the potential to get a great deal more serious. And I have enormous faith in the work that Bill Robichaud is doing for the SALA, and faith in the work of his colleagues. And frankly, let's look at it this way. Southeast Asia has the greatest concentration of creatures found only there, only in one place, the greatest rate of endemism, in a biological term, of any region on Earth. If we're really serious about conservation, about conserving biological diversity, we have to stay focused on Southeast Asia, because not only does it have the highest rate of biological endemism, it also has the greatest proportion of its plants and animals under immediate threat of extinction.
And when you talk about, I mean, what a profoundly important statement. When you talk about the biodiversity of the plant life, that's where some of the curative truth is. There are things that have been discovered there that have been critical in healing dreaded diseases. So we only have like less than 4 minutes left. And I'd like you to describe the setting up of the cameras once you, you know, reach your destination. I never even said to people at the beginning, which is so like me. Like I said, this needs to be a two-part show. The setting up of the cameras so that you could actually observe, the SALA could actually be observed, and the precision that took. And then I'd like your last thoughts on what that journey, completing this journey, meant to you and your life, and the impact that it has on everybody who's reading it. So it's all yours.
Okay.
In 3 minutes. Sorry.
Well, one of our purposes on the expedition was to set up and leave in place camera traps, cameras fastened to trees, pointed at a place where, let's say, a mineral lick, where wildlife are likely to come by, and SALA particularly. And so we set up these camera traps and left them in place so that they would record what they could record. In fact, our camera traps did not record any SALA, but in a big breakthrough in September of 2013, a camera trap in Vietnam did record a picture of a SALA, and that picture is on the last page of the book.
Loved it.
And people all around who cared about SALA were just thrilled that here was the first photographic evidence in, I think, 15 years of a live SALA in the wild. It was a great thing to see, and it gives hope. There's still
hope.
To pursue, to fasten on to. And what I came away from this trip most heavy or most front and center in my alleged mind was this idea that we had encountered so much beauty in that forest, in that jungle, that the beauty is under threat, that it is diminishing with the pressures being put on it. And yet, even with diminishment, so much beauty remains.
And your last day, I mean, I'll reread your last day when you had a moment and you were there and so descriptive of the magic that you got to see. We have 30 seconds left. I will have you back on the show. I hope our paths cross. Bill DeBuise, thank you for what you're doing. Everybody, I encourage you, and I will be writing about it, pick up a copy of The Last Unicorn. It's really epic and life-changing. It's about a search for one of Earth's rarest creatures likened to the mystical unicorn. Make it a great green week. June 20th, Jim Kolkert, switching gears and talking about propane. Bill, thank you.